Imagine you are sitting in the stadium. You're watching the World Cup round of 32.
Oh, the energy must be just insane.
Completely electric. Portugal is up 2-1 against Croatia. We're deep into stoppage time. And suddenly, Croatia's Joko Gvardiol slides in and scores what looks like a miraculous tying goal.
I mean, that is the exact kind of moment sports fans live for.
Exactly. The stadium erupts into pure, unadulterated chaos. And then, well, the video review steps in. The goal is negated, and that raw human joy is quietly erased by a microscopic sensor suspended inside the soccer ball, which is recording data 500 times a second.
It really is wild how fast the technology just shuts down the emotion.
It is. Welcome to your custom deep dive. Today, we are pulling from the July 5, 2026 edition of the Sunday Blender to explore a massive, invisible tug of war happening right now.
Right, the battle between our obsession with measuring every single data point and the wild, messy, fundamentally unpredictable nature of reality.
Yeah, and the editor of the Blender perfectly captured this vibe. They pointed out how much of modern life is just, vibe coding with AI. We just push buttons, let algorithms generate our work, multitask across three different screens.
Which is pretty much how everyone works these days.
Totally. But they noted one huge exception to that. Watching a high-stakes World Cup soccer match demands your full, undivided emotional presence. It is almost anti-2026 because you are surrendering to the unscripted drama.
You can't just swipe away from it. You're locked in.
Right. Okay, let's unpack this because even in a space as emotionally raw as the World Cup, that 2026 obsession with data has completely infiltrated the pitch. We are trying to quantify the magic.
And we're trying to turn human momentum into an exact millimeter-perfect science,
Right.
which brings us back to that negated Croatian goal against Portugal.
Yeah, the reason it was called back wasn't because of a blatant foul or anything obvious. It was because another Croatian player, Igor Matanovic, made a microscopic touch on the ball just before it reached an offside teammate.
A touch so incredibly light. I mean, it was completely invisible to the naked human eye.
Yeah, even the broadcast replays struggled to show it. People were furious.
But the ball felt it. You see, the official Adidas Trionda ball is essentially a Trojan horse for telemetry.
It's basically a computer you kick around.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
It has an inertial measurement unit, or IMU, suspended directly in its physical center by a network of tension wires. That sensor tracks acceleration and spatial positioning 500 times per second.
Wow, 500 times a second.
Yeah, and it syncs with optical cameras all around the stadium, so it registers the exact millisecond of kinetic displacement, meaning it knows when a boot brushes the leather, even if the human eye completely misses it.
Okay, I understand the engineering there, but I have to push back on the philosophy here. I mean, if we are measuring the game down to the literal millimeter in the millisecond, aren't we stripping the soul out of it?
That's the big debate, isn't it?
Yeah. The referee isn't making a human judgment call anymore. They're just reading a polygraph output from a piece of sporting equipment.
Well, what's fascinating here is that even with all that hyper-precise aerospace-grade technology inside the ball, the fundamental nature of the game itself completely defies easy prediction.
How so?
Because no matter how closely you measure the touch, you can't measure the human momentum. And to understand why, we really have to look at how actuaries and mathematicians view the sport.
Okay, I'm listening.
They look at it specifically through something called the Poisson distribution.
Wait, you're talking about the statistical engine behind all those World Cup betting odds, right?
Precisely. The Poisson distribution is a mathematical formula used for predicting the probability of a given number of events happening in a fixed interval of time.
And soccer goals fit into that.
Yeah, because soccer goals are incredibly rare and they're scattered across 90 minutes. This formula works because it assumes that goals are independent, memoryless events.
Memoryless. What does that mean in this context?
It means if a team scores in the 20th minute, the math dictates that it doesn't make scoring in the 70th minute mathematically more or less likely.
Wait. So the math actively ignores the concept of momentum. Any fan sitting in that stadium will tell you that a team that just scored is fired up. They have a massive psychological edge.
Sure, but the math doesn't care about human psychology. It describes soccer goals the exact same way it describes a meteor shower or the number of mutations in a strand of DNA.
So it's just pure randomness.
Exactly. Seeing one meteor doesn't change the physical odds of seeing another one 5 minutes later. So if a team averages 1.5 goals per game based on historical data, statisticians use the Poisson formula to calculate the exact odds of them scoring 0, 1, or 5 goals in their next match.
They treat the human players like random variables.
And they really do.
Which kind of reminds me of a joke from the sources that totally nails that disconnected vibe.
Oh boy, let's hear it.
Why do soccer players do so well in school? Because they know how to pass.
That is... wow, that's terrible.
I know, I know. But underneath the groans, it actually highlights something crucial. The math and the financial models tell us that if we input the right variables, specifically the most expensive players, we can predict the outcome.
Right, the old money buys championships logic.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But reality is refusing to cooperate. Here's where it gets really interesting.
Yeah.
Look at the actual financials of the squads in this tournament.
The open market valuations are absolutely staggering this year.
They really are. France is fielding a roster worth $1.65 billion. That's billion with a B.
Incredible.
And England, Spain, and Portugal all have squad valuations comfortably over $1 billion, too. And sure, those massive economies of scale usually buy performance. All of those teams advanced. But the models also broke down in spectacular fashion for others.
Oh, like Germany.
Exactly. Germany had the fifth most expensive squad in the whole tournament, valued at $1.07 billion. And they were knocked out by Paraguay on penalties.
Ouch.
And the Netherlands fielded a $904 million squad, and they fell to Morocco.
See, the metrics completely failed to account for intangibles. And there is no better example of that failure than Cape Verde.
Oh, man. The ultimate underdog narrative of 2026.
Such a great story.
For those who don't know, Cape Verde is a tiny island nation off the coast of West Africa. Total population is about 525,000.
That's smaller than most mid-sized American cities.
Yeah. But they lean heavily on their global diaspora, which they lovingly call their 11th island. And the way their coach, Bibista, built this team wasn't through massive financial acquisitions.
Right. He literally crowdsourced human capital across 14 different countries.
Yes. He was navigating decentralized networks to find talent that the major European scouting algorithms had completely overlooked.
Because the models weren't looking in the right places.
Exactly. He recruited a defender named Roberto Lopes, who was born and playing in Ireland, by sending him a direct message on LinkedIn in Portuguese.
A LinkedIn message.
LinkedIn message. And Lopes initially ignored it. He assumed it was a spam bot trying to sell him software or something.
I mean, I would have thought the same thing.
Right. But when he finally ran it through Google Translate, he realized it was an official national call-up. And this incredibly cheap, pieced-together squad went undefeated in the group stage.
It's unbelievable.
They drew against the European champions, Spain. They drew against Uruguay. They only finally fell to Argentina.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the contrast here is a glaring indictment of how we value things as a society right now.
How so?
Well, Cape Verde built a priceless, world-competing team for absolute pennies. They relied on decentralized human connection, grit, and, like you said, a translated LinkedIn message.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, over in the financial sector, we have the ultimate example of the exact opposite. Hype and algorithmic measurement completely overruling physical substance. Look at the SpaceX IPO.
Oh, the June 12th stock market earthquake.
Yep.
It became the largest initial public offering in history. It briefly overtook Amazon and Microsoft, instantly minting Elon Musk as the world's first trillionaire. Shares opened at $150 and just rocketed to $225 within days.
And investors were pricing in a 50% surge before the company even filed a single quarterly earnings report as a public entity. It was pure hype.
And then reality violently caught up. The stock cratered. It sank back below its original $150 price, wiping out roughly $1 trillion in market value in barely a week.
Just gone. It was one of the fastest wealth incinerations in the history of capital markets. And the mechanics of why it happened all come down to hubris.
Just ignoring the reality of the number.
Exactly. Financial analysts finally started looking at the underlying balance sheet and realized SpaceX had just taken on a massive pile of new debt, a $25 billion bond sale, specifically to fuel their artificial intelligence ambitions.
$25 billion just in debt.
Yes. Investors had pushed the valuation to over 100 times the company's actual sales.
Mm.
To put that in perspective, that is triple the valuation premium that NVIDIA commands. Wall Street's predictive models overvalued a tech dream by $1 trillion.
And the irony is, while Wall Street treated SpaceX's AI ambitions as this weightless, futuristic concept living up in the cloud, AI is actually incredibly heavy in the real world.
Very heavy.
We really need to talk about the physical weight of our digital ambitions here, because SpaceX isn't alone in this massive push.
No, not at all. The energy consumption required to sustain these predictive models is becoming a planetary crisis.
Yeah, Google just released data showing their electricity use jumped 37% in a single year.
37%.
And that spike is almost entirely driven by the massive data centers required to train and run their AI systems. They consumed more than 42 million megawatt hours of power.
That number is hard to even wrap your head around.
To give you some context, that is roughly the same amount of electricity used by the entire country of Denmark or New Zealand in a single year.
Just to power one single tech company's AI infrastructure, that is staggering.
It really is. Every single image we generate, every time we ask a chatbot to rewrite an email for us, it requires rows of specialized chips running at maximum capacity. They generate massive heat. They require industrial cooling systems.
And Google itself admits that the growth of AI is vastly outpacing our ability to add clean energy to the grid.
Which begs a really serious question for you listening right now. Are we comfortable trading the physical stability of our local power grids just so our chatbots can generate code a few milliseconds faster?
That is the core geopolitical tension of the decade. And that race for AI dominance isn't just straining power grids, you know. It is completely reshaping hardware supply chains worldwide.
Right, because the assumption has always been that the U.S. holds the keys to the physical hardware required for this scale of computing.
But look at what just happened in China with Meituan.
Yeah, Meituan is mostly known as a massive food delivery app, right?
Yeah, it's essentially the Chinese equivalent of DoorDash building an AI to rival Silicon Valley's big tech giants.
Which sounds crazy.
It does. But they just released a model called Longcat 2.0, and it boasts 1.6 trillion parameters.
1.6 trillion. Just explain parameters really quickly for us.
Sure. In AI terms, parameters are like the synaptic connections in a digital brain. They dictate how the model weights information and makes decisions. So 1.6 trillion puts it in the absolute upper echelon of global systems.
Okay, wow.
But the real shockwave isn't just the size. It's how they built it.
Right, because they didn't have access to the latest American hardware.
Exactly. Previously, Chinese models used domestic chips for inference, which is just answering the user's everyday questions. But they secretly relied on hoarded U.S. hardware for the intense, power-hungry training phase.
But not this time.
No. Longcat 2.0 was trained entirely on a cluster of more than 50,000 Chinese-made chips.
I mean, how is that even physically possible? I thought the bandwidth limitations on older chips would create a massive bottleneck if you tried to network that many together.
The whole industry assumed it was impossible. But Meituan's engineers utilized highly innovative networking architectures to handle parallel processing.
So they basically outsmarted the hardware limitation.
They essentially figured out how to split the computational workload across tens of thousands of slightly weaker processors without them bottlenecking each other during the communication phase. Mm. They bypassed the hardware ban with sheer software engineering ingenuity.
And it actually works well.
It performs incredibly well. It's already beating several benchmarks set by Google's Gemini.
It just proves that no matter how tightly we try to control the data or restrict the hardware, human engineering finds a backdoor.
Humans are stubborn like that.
Very true. But there is a ceiling to that hubris, right? Because no matter how advanced our clustering architectures get or how many trillions of parameters our AI has, we are still entirely at the mercy of a physical Earth that frankly does not care about our data.
The illusion of total measurement is never more obvious than when the tectonic plates decide to shift.
We saw this tragically with the devastating events in northwestern Venezuela. It was a geological phenomenon that scientists call an earthquake doublet.
Which is terrifying.
Two massive earthquakes, registering 7.2 and 7.5 in magnitude, struck just 39 seconds apart.
39 seconds.
Yeah.
The structural stress of that second wave hitting before buildings can even settle from the first is just catastrophic.
It was the strongest seismic event to hit Venezuela since 1900. Over 250 structures collapsed near Caracas and La Guaira, leaving a heartbreaking toll of more than 2,500 people dead.
It's devastating.
It is. But amid all that destruction, the international response was immediate. Rescue teams from the U.S., Jordan, and El Salvador flew in, just digging through the concrete. And they actually managed to pull a father out alive after he had been trapped under a collapsed shopping mall for 5 days.
Oh my goodness, 5 days. It is a stark reminder of how fragile our built environment really is against the sheer indifferent force of geology.
Yeah.
And, you know, it doesn't always take a massive tectonic doublet to prove that point either. Consider the sudden collapse off the coast of Malta on June 27th.
You mean the Kissing Elephants limestone arch?
Yes. It was a massive world-famous geological formation off the island of Camino. I mean, it was large enough for tourist boats to regularly pass underneath it.
Oh, wow.
And it collapsed directly into the sea in perfectly calm weather. There was no storm, no seismic trigger at all. It just gave way at the exact moment a tourist jumped from the top, and tragically, the falling rock killed a passing jet ski rider below.
That is just chillingly random. There's no narrative there. Just a terrible alignment of milliseconds.
But here is the core limitation of our obsession with metrics. Geologists actually spotted a structural crack in that rock 2 weeks prior.
Wait, they knew about it?
They had the data. They knew years of erosion had compromised the limestone. But all the data in the world, all the satellite observation and geological surveying, couldn't predict the exact second that gravity would finally overpower the molecular bonds of the stone.
Right.
We can measure the conditions perfectly, but we just cannot predict the outcome.
So how do we actually advance? I mean, how do we survive in a world where the ground literally falls out from under us without warning, where our trillion-dollar financial models crash overnight, and where a microscopic touch on a soccer ball erases a moment of human triumph?
We do what humans have always done when the metrics fail.
Which is?
We use our ingenuity to completely rewrite the rules of the system. We abandon the old data set entirely and invent a new paradigm.
Okay, a perfect example of that is the new mRNA flu vaccine detailed in Nature Immunology. For decades, the biological rule was straightforward. You make a flu shot by predicting the dominant strain 6 months in advance, and then you slowly grow weakened viruses inside millions of chicken eggs.
Millions of eggs.
Oh.
It is an incredibly analog, tedious process.
Very.
And you're locked into a biological gamble based on outdated data by the time flu season actually arrives.
Exactly. But scientists decided to skip the egg and the guessing game entirely. Leveraging the mRNA technology that gained prominence during the COVID-19 pandemic, they aren't injecting a weakened virus anymore.
So how does it work now?
They are delivering a programmable set of instructions directly to the cells, telling them to build a harmless protein to trigger a broad immune response.
That's brilliant.
It is. An FDA panel just unanimously recommended it for adults 50 and older, with full approval expected this August. They stopped trying to predict the flu's timeline and instead altered the epidemiological speed limit entirely.
This raises an important question, though. What does it mentally take for a person to abandon the accepted rules like that?
That's a good question.
If we look back at history, true breakthroughs rarely come from simply gathering more data on the existing models.
Yeah.
They happen when someone decides the accepted data is fundamentally flawed. Take Isaac Newton, for example.
Okay, let's go back to Newton.
On June 5, 1661, an 18-year-old Newton arrived at Trinity College, Cambridge.
And he wasn't exactly welcomed as a prodigy, right? Didn't he arrive as a subcisar?
Yes, basically working as a servant to the wealthier students just to pay his room and board.
Man, what a start.
And the official university curriculum he was forced to study was totally anchored in Aristotle. The professors were teaching 2,000-year-old ideas about motion, gravity, and the universe as if they were settled, immutable metrics.
But Newton wasn't buying it.
Not at all. He kept a private notebook, which he titled Certain Philosophical Questions. When the university was forced to shut down during the Great Plague, he retreated into isolation.
Like a 17th century lockdown.
Exactly. But he didn't use that time to memorize Aristotle's data. He used it to completely tear apart those 2,000-year-old assumptions.
Without the burden of the accepted metrics, he essentially sketched out the foundations of calculus, figured out the optics of how white light splits into colors, and began formulating the universal law of gravitation.
He threw out the existing map and drew an entirely new one.
So what does this all mean? I think Newton, using his imagination to decode reality, connects beautifully to how we use imagination to invent reality through art.
Oh, I like where this is going.
Consider the Japanese artist Utagawa Hiroshige.
The legendary woodblock printmaster from the Edo period.
Yes. And Hiroshige was actually a former fire warden who eventually turned to art. In 1832, he traveled the Tokaido Road, which was the main route connecting Edo to Kyoto.
Right. A very famous journey.
He produced a series of 55 woodblock prints documenting the stations along the journey, and the series became a massive cultural sensation. But the most famous piece from that entire collection print, number 45, known as Shono, is a complete geographic fabrication.
Wait, really? He abandoned the physical data of the location?
Completely. He arrived at the Shono station, looked at the real physical scenery, and decided to just ignore it. Instead, he invented a sudden, violent summer rainstorm.
Oh, wow.
If you look at the print, you see travelers dashing desperately uphill and downhill, bracing their bodies against these aggressive, slanted sheets of rain that Hiroshi's carved directly into the woodblock.
That sounds incredibly striking.
It is. He painted bamboo bending sideways in the wind, fading out into layers of gray. He didn't act as a censor, recording the geographic data. He invented a storm from pure imagination to capture the emotional reality of travel, and it became an absolute masterpiece.
He captured the human vulnerabilities being caught in the unpredictable elements, which is honestly far more enduring than a literal map of the trees would have been.
Exactly. And we are constantly surrounded by this blending of history, art, and modern technology. Just look at the culture right now. The U.S. is currently celebrating its semi-quincentennial 250 years since 1776.
It's hard to believe it's been 250 years.
I know. The U.S. Mint just released 250,000 special July 4th quarters into everyday circulation. You might literally get a piece of commemorative history handed to you at a coffee shop today.
And that quiet historical milestone is happening against the incredibly loud backdrop of the U.S. co-hosting the World Cup, alongside an absolutely massive summer at the box office.
The cultural synthesis at the movies right now is just wild. You have Minions and Monsters tracking for an $80 million weekend. You've got Disney's live-action Moana, a new Spider-Man entry. But the defining film of the summer is Christopher Nolan's The Odyssey.
Oh, with Matt Damon starring as Odysseus. Battling mythological sea monsters.
Exactly. It's a 3,000-year-old poem by Homer, born out of oral tradition, and it's now being retold using the most cutting-edge, massive IMAX camera technology available in 2026.
We are using our most advanced lenses to capture our oldest myths.
Beautifully said.
And that really brings us to a crucial realization about all of this. Think about the concept of Goodhart's Law. The idea that when a measure becomes a target, it ceases to be a good measure.
Right.
We are currently building trillion-parameter AI models trained entirely on the data exhaust of our own past.
Right.
We're trying to perfectly predict our reality.
Trying to map the hurricane.
Exactly. Mm. But if AI is essentially a mirror reflecting the data of everything we've already done, then the only things it will never be able to predict are the leaps that braid the data set entirely. The future doesn't belong to the system that perfectly tracks a soccer ball 500 times a second.
No, it doesn't.
It belongs to the next Isaac Newton sitting in isolation, or the next Hiroshi inventing a storm out of nothing. The most vital human achievements will always be the ones that defied measurement until the exact moment they changed the world.
A brilliant reminder that sometimes the most important thing you can do is just step off the measured map entirely. Thank you for spending your time with us on this custom deep dive. Keep questioning the metrics, hold on to your unpredictability, and we will catch you next time.